You're listening to A Light at the Other Side, where we're sharing stories of resilience, healing, and hope. We share the experiences of adoptees, domestic violence survivors, military veterans, and more, so some episodes may contain potentially triggering accounts of trauma. To fully appreciate the light, we must sometimes peer into the dark. On today's episode, I'm going to share a little bit about my experience in the Navy. I do cover some veteran stories in my publication, Served, so I'd just like to share some of my personal experiences during my time in the Navy. The open sea and denial. How serving in the U.S. Navy can be a delight to the senses if you ignore reality. I lifted my leg over the knee knocker and stepped outside, zipping my utility jacket all the way up under my chin while balancing my coffee mug. The air was sharp and the breeze brisk this morning. Standing on the metal grating 60 feet above the surface of the sea, I lit my cigarette with both hands, one cupped around the end of the white stick, blocking the whipping wind. One strike, two strikes, and on the third strike, the lighter caught the paper and I inhaled deeply. Leaning down to pick up my mug, I could see the dark blue-green water lapping gently against the side of the gray hull. The sun had just crested the line where the sea meets the sky, its orange glow creeping upwards by the second, pushing back indigo skies with a persistent crescent moon still hanging around. The beauty contrasted with the griminess of the ship, and I inhaled the dichotomy in delirious pleasure. I wasn't the only one on the smoke deck that morning, but daybreak smokes were for individual awakening, not group chat. The morning was quiet. Each absorbed in our thoughts, we could hear the slap of waves, the hum of the ship, and distant shouts of our shipmates working, wrapping up the night shift. One cigarette turned into two, my coffee mug ran low, and I ran a mental checklist of what I needed to accomplish that day. As it neared time for muster, we reluctantly crushed our butts into the metal pail filled halfway with sand and shuffled inside, ready to start our day. Not everyone on my ship started their day at sunrise on the smoke deck. In fact, it was a relatively quiet time to head out onto this scaffolding over the sea. I've never been much of a breakfast person, so I skipped the mess decks most mornings and just grabbed a coffee and my smokes to greet the sun anew every day. It was a strange place to exist, to be honest. I've always been a nature lover, a hiker, swimmer, explorer of the wild. The sea is perhaps the most unexplored, wildest terrain yet, and our billion-dollar steel warships float on her surface completely at her mercy. Us sailors bustle around in them like ants in an anthill, one perched precariously on hundreds of feet of unpredictable water. When the skyline is a full circle, nothing but sea in every direction, the horizon feels like merely a suggestion, sometimes indiscernible. The sky melts into the sea in a haze on foggy or cloudy days, making it feel like our ship was a decoration inside a gray snow globe. Being a sailor is a calling, I'm convinced. There was always the Air Force, after all. There's a line in one of my favorite songs, and don't judge me now, but when Kermit the Frog croons, "Have you been half asleep, and have you heard voices? I've heard them calling my name. Is this the sweet sound that calls the young sailors? The voice might be one and the same. I've heard it too many times to ignore it. It's something that I'm supposed to be." I'm convinced that the calling of the sea was not just to me, but is an actual phenomenon. After all, we recruit thousands of men and women every year who volunteer to step aboard a floating steel city and sail into waters unknown to brave nor'easters and hurricanes, attack by unseen enemies, and the ever-present risk of joining Davy Jones in his locker in the deep. Before shipping off to boot camp, I awoke many times in a sweat after dreaming of drowning, trapped in a metal tomb as water filled the space and then my lungs. My friends, who insisted on watching films like Red October in those months, didn't help at all. In basic training, we had to pass a certain exercise before we graduated, an exercise that realized some of my worst nightmares. In a giant section of a ship, we practiced how to save valuable equipment and ourselves in case of disaster. As the space filled with gushing water, we had to work as a team to first empty the space of munitions and other equipment and then escape ourselves by crawling through an exposed air duct. Have I yet mentioned that I am claustrophobic? One too many times locked in a closet in a certain foster home ensured that small dark spaces would forever make my skin crawl. But on that last night of basic training, I had to shut down the screaming in my head and crawl through that dark, small air duct as water rapidly approached its lip, lest I fail the exercise and be doomed to repeat it until I succeeded. And so I did. I screamed back at the voice in my head, I dove headfirst into that little hole, and I held my breath as I crawled through what felt like an eternity to emerge, breathless and shaking, in safety on the other side. After this exercise, I thought I would feel depleted and anxious, but I felt a rush of adrenaline, energy, and confidence. I had braved one of my worst fears and emerged unscathed. What more could any of us ever hope for? It was this confidence that propelled me through the rest of that night, leading the charge at the front of my division, running wildly through the cold night as we tackled challenge after challenge to end up dirty, tired, but proud, as we removed our recruit caps and replaced them with real Navy covers. This same confidence fueled my journey through a male-dominated world as I learned to stand up for myself, stick to my guns, push back against sexism and misogyny, and demand respect for myself throughout my years of military service. The only space this confidence didn't enter was that of the awareness of what our nation was doing. Being in the U.S. Navy during Operation Iraqi Freedom and Operation Enduring Freedom meant one thing for sure. We were at relatively low risk of seeing active combat. There's just no place for a warship in the desert. We were secondhand witnesses to what our nation was doing to the Iraqi people and their land, cities, and homes. We saw the same footage that civilians did, played in brief clips on the evening news. An American soldier geared up to their eyeballs, kicking down door after door in Baghdad. Tsk, tsk. We'd shake our heads as we went back to our administrative work, the work that built the massive undergirding of military support to what those soldiers were doing. Yet, as bodies ran low in the Army, the Secretary of Defense began recruiting bodies from other branches of the military. If a sailor had no dependents, they may find themselves on a list, an unlucky lottery of Navy sailors chosen to go fill boots on the ground in Baghdad or wherever needed. This is how sailors who anticipated a life at sea found themselves neck deep in an active combat zone. This is how men and women who were called by the sea were hooked, dragged from the ethereal beauty of the ocean into the arid desert, into shootouts with children, how they found themselves face down in sand and blood, crying for their mothers and their wives and husbands and children as their lives drained out of their bodies. This is how we sat, confused and angry and heartbroken when we received word that our fellow sailor wasn't coming back to us. The sea had been his life, and the desert took it from him. This is how we stomped up to the smoke deck, leaned over the railing, and blinked back tears as we watched the horizon as if just over that line there were answers. How to end war, how to bring them back, how to stop the madness. How to reconcile our little part in this big, ugly machine that mass-produced death and suffering. And then we would hear the gentle lapping, the calling and calming of the sea. The sun would set, the close of a day, the end of a life. The next day, the sun would break over that horizon once more. I would study it, one eye squinting as I took a long drag of my cigarette and pondered life and death, war and peace, turmoil and pain, as the water lapped gently against our hull. the beauty of the sea forever lulling us back, comforting our grief, pushing us on just as the tide is forever reshaping our earth, hurtling our warships toward wanton death, and then scooping us safely back home. The ebb and flow of life and death, incomparable to anything else, exposed out on the sea. Serving in the military is a unique experience in itself. And serving on a U.S. ship during a war that was predominantly in a desert, and serving as a short timer, as we would sometimes say, which is somebody who only did 4 years. I did a 4-year enlistment, which I'm very proud of, but it also places my voice in a place where I don't always feel comfortable speaking about my experiences, because in my mind, there are veterans that are more veteran-y than me, right? These are men and women who went into active combat, who served for 20 years of their life. And so I'm always cautious to throw my voice into the ring. But as I get older and as life progresses, I realize that all of our voices are incredibly valuable. And I look back on that period of my life, and I honestly, really genuinely can't believe that I went through basic training, that I went to a ship, that I served on a ship. It's really sort of mind-boggling that I was able to do that at that age and to take on that degree of responsibility. And I am proud of myself, and I'm proud of every single one of us that stood up and served our country during that time. And then there's the flip side of it also, where many facets of what the U.S. military did through the course of the war in Iraq and then further on Afghanistan aren't entirely ethically sound. And of course, at the time, we didn't know all the complexities of what was going on in the world, in global politics, in even in our own politics. You gotta remember that the vast majority of enlisted people are young. A lot of people go in at 18. So you have 18 to 22-year-olds making up a really big part of our workforce, and we're doing what we're told to do. We're going where we're told to go, and we don't always think or even are educated enough at that point to be aware of the greater global implications of, or ethical and moral implications of what we're doing. So it's been a lot for, I believe, for a lot of veterans of my generation who did serve in that time period from 2001 to 2010, roughly that time period where we served in Operation Iraqi Freedom and Operation Enduring Freedom. And to find out later, to find out many years later, that perhaps there never were weapons of mass destruction, and perhaps what we as a nation were doing wasn't the most ethically sound, and we had direct involvement in that. And so that's kept a lot of people from openly discussing it. And then there's the trauma aspect, that many people don't want to discuss their military service because of trauma they saw or sort of secondhand that they heard, even if they didn't experience active combat themselves. We've all heard stories, and every one of us, I believe, that has served lost someone during that period of active service who wasn't so lucky as we are. So then there's survivor's guilt. And then on top of that whole medley, you take the fact that most veterans are men, and their stories, men don't want to talk so much. I have found a lot of men just don't want to talk, and particularly about emotional or difficult or traumatic experiences. They don't want to talk about it. I'm seeing a lot of older gentlemen on my publication served who were veterans during Vietnam. And as they're entering their twilight years, they are ready to talk, and they're starting to share their stories
of their experiences serving in Vietnam, which is absolutely priceless to me, and I'm trying to make as respectful and honoring of a place to publish those stories as possible. If you're listening and you have any military experience whatsoever, I would also love to publish your stories in Served, and you can always get in touch with me at thelightattheotherside@gmail.com to discuss that, because I really want to share as many stories as possible. I know on my podcast I've discussed a lot about my transgender son and how I'm very passionate about the advocacy work that I do for him and for all LGBT kids in America. And I've also talked a lot about my adoption, and I'm very passionate about my advocacy work to abolish adoption and establish legal guardianship and how to best protect vulnerable children in our society. And my third sort of bucket that I'm very passionate about is veterans. And with every aspect of my work, my central theme is auditing the narrative. In each of these three buckets, adoptees, LGBT kids, and veterans, there is a narrative out there in our society that is formulated, crafted, designed, and deployed by entities of power who have an entirely different narrative that they want the general public to believe. With adoptees, adoption agencies, attorneys, social workers, lots of people involved in the system want the general public to believe a narrative about adoption that simply isn't true. And as a result, I'm sharing the stories of adoptees, those children that are most impacted by the institution of adoption, who are adults at this time, who are in their 40s, 50s, 60s, and are really speaking up and saying, this needs to stop, okay? Adoption messed me up for life, and it needs to stop. In the way that it's implemented here in America, it needs to stop. It's not good for children. And likewise, the narrative about trans kids is being formulated by politicians and political entities around the nation to push certain agendas. And the target of those agendas, the scapegoat, the people that they're using to legislate actions are kids, are trans kids. So I'd like to audit that narrative and give the perspective of parents who are raising trans kids, and to shake loose those presumptions that we are groomers and pedophiles and we're mutilating our children. So that's why I'm very passionate about sharing my experience parenting a trans kid and his experience as a trans kid in America to push back against that narrative that's coming down from politicians to serve their, you know, selfish agendas that really has nothing to do with the kids or the welfare of the kids. And along the same lines, politicians have used veterans for decades to gain clout, to gain political favor. People who never served in the military, who had very convenient reasons for not serving, they had flat feet or they were out of the country or they, whatever the case may be, these people have now reached positions of power, typically elected positions of power, and they use veterans, this very simplistic, ultra-patriotic sort of version of a veteran, to make laws and legislation and further military action that puts our young men and women in harm's way and leaves lasting impact, lasting mental duress on a great percentage of these young men and women who serve. We have enormous rates of veteran PTSD and suicide. And when I speak to veterans, even those who aren't like me, who served on a ship, wasn't in active combat, and served a relatively short period of time in 4 years, but people who served 8, 10, 20 years, they're experiencing serious ramifications from their military service. And they're just asking to be heard and respected. And that's the point of served, is to publish those stories with dignity, with respect, and to give veterans the freedom to use their own words to express their military service. A unique group of veterans is women. We have served in the military for almost 100 years now. In the beginning, of course, it was administrative positions as nurses, obviously. But through the years, we have pushed and pushed our way into more and more difficult roles within the military. Every woman I met in the military was a fighter, was tough. You have to be tough to even attempt to go into such a male-dominated world, a physically demanding world. You have to be tough and you have to be able to withstand a base level of harassment, really, is the best way to put it. Now, I don't want to say that unilaterally we were harassed every day across the board. I had many wonderful years in the military, and I met an enormous amount of people, men and women, who were great, upstanding, fine people, who I'm still friends with, who I've loved watch through the years on, you know, first MySpace and then Facebook as they got married and had children and their children grew and some of their children have moved out and started families of their own, and watching that sort of unfold on social media with these people that I served with is a very special experience. And I feel like I'm a part of their extended family, and they are certainly a part of mine. So in that vein, I did write a piece specifically targeted at the women in uniform. I wanted to give a salute for National Women's Day, which was a few days ago, that called out specifically the women who stepped up to serve their country, and to just give them a little bit of honor and an extra salute on that day, because they truly are some of the most amazing people I've ever met in my life. And through the years since, I've watched how they have just tackled life. I have shipmates who have gone on to achieve amazing, amazing things, and I'm very proud of them, and I'm proud to know them. So my next piece is going to be particularly devoted to the women in uniform. A salute to women in uniform. My sisters in arms became my friends and my heroes for life. The air was still dark and the air biting cold as our bus pulled up to Great Lakes Recruit Training Command. Men and women in sharply creased uniforms appeared as if from nowhere, barking orders for us to disembark and form into two lines, men to the right, women to the left. Move, move, move. I looked to the women on the left and right of me, a tall black woman who looked strong and fit, and a petite Hispanic woman whose face was already set for battle. Wow, I thought, these women are badass. What am I doing here? Just then, the door to the ominous gray building opened and we began filing inside. The woman ahead of me looked back and shot me a warm smile. The sisterhood began. We were plunged into a whirlwind of 18-hour days where we were stripped of our clothes, our hair, our dignities, pressed in lines that men called nut to butt, but we experienced as boob to back, and every possible shred of our individualism was wiped away. We were measured and received uniforms tailored to our bodies, uniforms that after 8 weeks of intense physical conditioning would hang loosely from our frames and would have to be cinched with belts. We entered in groups of four, a large room with four open toilets bolted to the floor, clutching plastic cups to squat across from another woman and piss into said cups for drug testing. We lined up separately a couple of days later to go one at a time into a room where we women were all given invasive gynecological examinations, STD testing, pregnancy testing, and pap smears, and forced to select a method of birth control for the entirety of boot camp, the shot or the pill.
Refusal was not an option. We showered in a large open tile room with 8 shower heads. If you weren't comfortable with the nude female form, you got pretty comfortable with it pretty fast. After the complete confusion and shock to the system of the first few days, we slowly began peeking around our blinders and connecting with the women around us. We slowly became friends. Life in basic training in 2003 for a woman was intense. We had 3 recruit division commanders, frequently known as drill commanders or what the Army calls drill sergeants. One was female, our chief, and 2 were male, subordinate to her. One of our male RDCs was a former Army drill sergeant, and I'm not sure he got any training to differentiate his behavior from that of the Army. I'm saying he was unhinged. But for the most part, our RDCs treated us fairly but firmly and held us to the same expectations and standards as our male counterparts. I'm sure having a female chief ensured this paradigm. She ruled the roost and demanded respect with her bearing, her countenance, her words, and her actions. She wasn't one of the girls, but she had our back in issues with the men. As basic training commenced, we formed smaller friend groups among the female half of the division. I became friends with a blonde from Ohio with an infectious grin and sparkling eyes, Megan. She made us laugh and kept things light. 21 years later, we're still friends. We cleaned our barracks together. We did PT together. We ate together. Hell, we showered together and pissed together. We cried together. We sang together as we scrubbed floors together. We sat together, knee to knee on the floor, as we were told about the conflict in Iraq and our blood ran cold. We talked together quietly into the night that night about what our future held. We read each other's love letters from back home. We looked at photos of each other's boyfriends and husbands, children, pets, and families. We went to chapel together. We prayed together. We yelled encouragement at one another on obstacle courses and runs through ice and snow. We pulled each other up when we fell. We had each other's backs unequivocally and without question. Basic training was not always designed for women's comfort, physical or mental. On our first day of swim training, our crewed RDC instructed us to don our black one-piece swimsuits and, quote, shave it and stuff it. We don't want to see hair or blood. I was aghast but didn't show it. We could never show our shock at the way women were spoken to, or the rhetoric would have increased tenfold. At the end of those intense weeks, we stood shoulder to shoulder, our hair slicked back under our covers, our crisp white crackerjack uniforms perfectly pressed and creased, wearing the approved shade of lipstick and a touch of mascara, having seen some of our sisters fall away in the process, and those of us remaining marched through pass and review on a blustery May day before heading our separate ways to training schools around the nation. After 4 months of training school and a brief respite at home, we went to our assigned commands for the ensuing years of our enlistments. I was assigned to the USS Dwight D. Eisenhower. I'll never forget my first day reporting to my ship. She was in the shipyards, in dry dock at that, and if you've never seen an entire aircraft carrier lifted from the water, I don't believe I could properly describe the sheer size and presence. It literally took my breath away. I was picked up at the barracks after reporting and piled onto a golf cart with 2 other new sailors. We careened through an extensive parking lot full of both cars and cranes, huge pieces of metals, propellers larger than school buses, pipes, spools of wire and chain, and then we dipped down to a lower level of the shipyard and whipped around a corner, and there she was, larger than life. A monstrous gray structure rising out of the steel girders of the dry dock, her flight deck hanging almost obscenely over the pier, shading those below. I'd never seen anything so big in my life. The female sailor driving the golf cart looked over at me and laughed. "Trust me, it gets real small, real quick," she quipped before dropping us off in front of the gangplank and taking off. I ignored with every fiber of my being my fear of heights as I ascended a metal gangplank that rose higher and higher above the concrete pier and dark water below. I saluted sharply, showed my fresh new military ID, and requested permission to come aboard. Granted that access, I stepped foot on the vessel that would be my home, my workplace, my comfort zone, my playground, my life for the next couple of years.
Trying desperately to not look stupid and remember what we learned about ship's markings from basic training, I clutched a sheet of paper guiding me to 0290-1. That's probably not accurate. It's been 20 years. It was our ship's radio space and what would become my first office. After almost 30 minutes of stubborn searching and refusing to ask for help, I stepped into our radio space. A woman turned to me and smiled. We are still friends today. Another few women came into the space shortly after, returning from lunch. They smiled and greeted me warmly, introducing themselves and offering to show me around the shop and introduce me to the rest of the division. We are still friends today. In the following months, we worked as a tight team to complete the outfitting of our IT spaces, to run tens of thousands of feet of Cat 5 cable through overheads and connect them to 16 edge switches as we installed an entire network on board the ship. We ate together, we slept together, we worked together, we bitched and vented together, we studied for testing together, we celebrated advancing in rank together, we spotted each other tampons and pads, Midol and Tylenol, we went out for whiskey and beer together to celebrate birthdays, promotions, engagements, and to commiserate through divorces. We watched each other level up. I watched these women remain professional under consistent and systemic misogyny, keeping cool heads when men's emotions flared. We helped one another gel down our flyaways and perfect the sleek bun for inspections and award ceremonies. We threw on firefighting suits and gear for battle stations alongside our male counterparts, running up ladder wells, dragging fire hoses with solid brass couplings, our brawn matching theirs step for step. The women I met in the military were consistently some of the smartest, most hardworking, impressive human beings I've ever met. Despite their challenges at home, despite having to leave their children, despite philandering husbands, they turned their attention with laser focus to the defense of our nation. I watched women ace testing, fly through promotions, achieve higher and higher rank and status through grueling hard work, sleepless nights, and untold sacrifice, only to be accused of sucking and fucking her way to the top by jealous male sailors who couldn't stand that a woman outperformed them. I also watched my male shipmates intervene in cases of sexual harassment and confrontations with female sailors, so they certainly weren't all bad. But there was enough of the gender-based discrimination against female sailors that made it that much harder for us to be taken seriously and respected for our work and skill. Our achievements couldn't just unilaterally be celebrated. There was always the cloud of accusation and sleazy assumption that female sailors somehow always had some sexual edge to their accomplishments. And still, we persisted. Through shipyards and deployments, through times of war and peace, women stepped away from their homes and families in service to their nation. I'm proud to have been one of those women. I'm especially proud to know those women. I'm beyond blessed to call those women my friends. Adjusting back to civilian life was definitely somewhat of a struggle. I learned what a hard edge I had assumed during my military service. The years of being in male-dominated spaces had made me put up a bit of a defense and slapped a bite on my communication with others. I had to ease up a bit. But adjust I did, and I had some female friends in my department as a government contractor after leaving active duty. But we went home at night, to our actual homes, and we only interacted during the day, like a regular 9-to-5 job. It wasn't the same. The sisterhood wasn't there. I missed my sisters in uniform. I missed the secret vernacular we shared, the specific and unique lifestyle we knew so intimately, the smell of the steel and jet fuel, even the muscle memory of lifting your leg high every 6 or 7 steps to clear the knee knockers of each frame on the ship. I've never been too much of a gaggle of girlfriends type of woman. I've always been a bit of a loner and had 1 or 2 very close friends. But when I was active duty in the Navy, I was inherently part of the most exclusive, amazing, robust, and profound sisterhood of my life. Those women were representative of the lifeblood of America. Black women, Hispanic and Latina women, Indigenous women, Asian and white women, all banding together for a common cause in an environment where many times it wasn't only the enemy that was hostile. I met women from the Bronx and from Oakland, from the fields of Kansas and the Gulf of Alabama.
I was empowered by seeing these strong women hold their own in an extremely male-dominated space and not just survive, but rise to astounding heights. I pushed against assumptions and presumptions, stereotypes and generations of typecasting when I enlisted, just like every other woman. We had to watch our accomplishments and achievements be belittled and dismissed as nothing more than the result of a sexual favor, not our hard work. And still we persisted. In the evenings, we ate together on the mess decks, shared a lighter on the smoke decks as we watched the sunset, and played. They played. I lost, hopelessly. Spades in the berthing before sliding into our racks, stacked three high, only to awake at 0530 and do it all again. Together. Never before or since have I been a part of something that was always challenging, but consistently inspiring and empowering. I will miss it every day until my soul departs. The women of our United States military are beyond mere warriors because we also hold space for maternal warmth and gentleness, domestic comfort, and feminine beauty and grace. We wear red lipstick while we harbor the art of combat that we can wield at a moment's notice to defend our democracy. We are hard and soft, lethal and nurturing, at once capable of giving life and ending it. Trained and poised to execute the mission at a moment's notice, we don combat gear as our menses rages and PCOS, endometriosis, and uterine cyst drive daggers into our bodies. We are warriors of boundless strength who carry with us centuries of feminine energy and rage and power, and yet comport ourselves with dignity and austerity while donning the uniform of our nation's armed forces and enduring the condescending sexualization and sexism therein. We are enigmas, beings who can straddle the world of the masculine and feminine to push boundaries and stereotypes, to stand alongside our brothers in arms in the defense and preservation of our nation. We are warriors. We are women. We are strength and poise personified, and our strength is only amplified in our sisterhood. We stand, we roar, we conquer together.
Thank you again for tuning in, and I'll see you next week.